You are listening to The Change Society Show, brought to you by Sullivan and Stanley and your host, Pat Lines. If you're looking for the benchmark in empathetic leaders, look no further than Phil Anderson. Our guest today is COO of Legal & General, who chats with our host, Pat, on a wide set of topics across transformation, agile, and innovation. We try not to talk about COVID too much, but the way Phil and his team navigate an incredible flurry of changes both digitally and personally is to be admired. Naturally, Phil heaped praise on his team rather than himself, but it's clear that his calming influence throughout was a major factor in their success. To boot, Pat and Phil dive into how Phil manages his energy as an incredibly busy executive, as well as his scaling ambition for L&G. All this to look forward to, so please enjoy the show.
Phil, it's great to have you on the Change Society show after so long. I remember clearly coming down to see you pre the pandemic down in Hove and thinking that, you know, you were doing some terrific stuff there and that you really had, you know, a grasp on innovation in that particular sector. And I always thought maybe one day we'd get to do a show together. And then the pandemic hit and I was quite impressed with, you know, your messaging above the line on some of the stuff that you were doing as a COO in Legal & General, and it's great that you've decided that you'd like to share your story today. So, you know, format can be quite different for the Change Society show. Sometimes we have thought leaders that, you know, have a particular thing that they want to talk about, but what I really like is sharing people's journeys and stories as a leader, you know. So this is good. So look, without further ado, welcome to the show, and could you do a bit of an introduction on who you are, what you do, and maybe a bit of a claim to fame?
Okay, yeah, so thanks very much for the invite. Really good to speak. I'm Philip Anderson, clearly. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for Legal & General's institutional retirements business. And my office is in Hove, but we have offices in London, in Cardiff, and actually also in Bermuda and the US. My team and my role covers all things related to business transformation, technology, including new technology or running existing technology, as well as elements of the business's strategy, our operating model, operational resilience, keeping us safe, as well as some of the softer things. So I'm also in charge of our internal and external communications and our brand within LGRI. I'm also the location director outside LGRI for our Hove office. I'm kind of passionate about the Brighton and Hove area. It's a great place to work. It's a great place to live and all that kind of stuff. So it's a really good opportunity to kind of bring that to life as well for the business and for the external market. I've also, in the last 6 months, taken on responsibility for our whole group for operational resilience, which is obviously a lot of focus from the regulator on that right now. So that's a big change journey for us. So a fairly diverse role. I've been fortunate enough to be asked to get involved in all kinds of stuff and, you know, love what I do, actually, I have to say.
I remember when I was at university, the last thing I probably thought I was going to get into is consulting. So may I ask the question, how did you get into becoming a change and transformation leader? And yeah, what drew you to L&G? You know, what motivated you to get into that particular sector?
Yeah, I'm exactly the same as you. This is not something I kind of studied for or believed that I would end up in. I didn't actually go to university. I decided not to go into higher education and joined the world of work. And I started in retail management with Sainsbury's and then with Tesco. I actually kind of liked the pace of retail and sort of the variety and the speed with which they would adapt to the market was all quite interesting, great opportunities and so on and so forth. But I then moved into BT and took on a role in contact centres and more around performance management and all that kind of stuff and deep operational management. And I think what I found is that actually the things that I really enjoyed doing were, as well as running things as they are today, were thinking about how they could be tomorrow and in the future. And I almost became and sort of evolved into this, I perhaps don't want to use the term, but change agent within an operational role, and found that I suppose I was just quite good at identifying and steering people towards change. Having got a grasp for that, I then went freelance from BT, and that's when I really moved into kind of project management and change management and technology change and did various roles on a freelance basis before I landed at Legal & General. And Legal & General was a fairly specific move on my part. I'd been working in Australia And that was on a fixed term basis for 2 years, which I loved, but I knew that I was coming back to the UK. And in this area, I was just keen to broaden my horizons a bit within financial services. Bupa clearly is financial services, which is who I was working for in Australia, but I kind of got a bit of a taste for the kind of change agenda and some of the challenges in that sector. So I just reached out to Legal & General to, you know, to see what opportunities were going, and kind of the rest is history in a way, and it sort of fell into place. So I actually only joined Legal & General for 3 months initially, I think it was. It was a bit of an assignment to help them with a building that they were exiting in Kingswood and devising a strategy for how their people could work differently. And it just kind of grew legs from there, really. So I took on a role as a program manager for that, and then a head of transformation for a division, helping them incorporate that for the rest of the group. And then the transformation director, who was in the retirements division at that stage, announced that she would be retiring. And it just felt like a good opportunity, a good culture, great business. I was involved in things that I really, really enjoyed doing. Felt like I had a good brand around the business, certainly what people told me. Applied for it and was successful. And then it's just continued from there, really. So I think Legal & General is one of the longest assignments I've been on now, if that makes sense. I've worked for them probably longer than anybody else. If I think about it, possibly BT was maybe a year longer. But it is so exciting and so different. And 1 week really is so different from the last. I think I sort of kind of found my change spiritual home. That's not a strange thing to say, because I really believe in what L&G are trying to do. And I really love where I work and who I work with.
Yeah. And are you able to talk a bit more about that then, what L&G are trying to do? Because I remember you talking and highlighting what the business strategy was pre-pandemic. And I can always see, and you can see it now, your passion for the brand and you know how the ways of working are there and what the people are like and, you know, the sort of freedom you've had to do what you need to do and all those kind of good things. I think it'd be really good to maybe get a bit of color around that.
Yeah, okay. So I think the at the group level, at the highest level, our strategy is around inclusive capitalism. And that purpose runs through everything that we're trying to do. So that, for me, I would boil that down outside of how we've formally worded it to say, which is in financial services, of course, we drive significant profit and we drive significant sums of money through the market. But there are ways of doing that that have a broader societal impact. So we are a significant player in the house building market, for example. You know, we've got significant house building operations and I'm really seeking to change the rental market and various aspects of that. So that's a really good example of something that a lot of people aren't aware is part of the L&G kind of proposition and really links to that idea about making money to reinvest in society, community, and for the greater good. And our environmental credentials and our passion for developing solutions that really support some of the challenges we've got around climate change is top of the agenda across the board. You know, our group CEO frequently mentions that probably every single communication or kind of town hall type thing that he's running, and you can see that passion. And I think that's quite infectious around the business. It's one of the most connected and purpose-led organizations I think I've ever been aware of to a certain extent. And I think we're quite good at helping people understand where they fit into that or how they could fit into that and then how they could fit into that in the future. So that strong purpose resonates strongly with me. I found a degree of that at Bupa as well in terms of their mission to help people live kind of healthier, happier, longer lives. And I think L&G, it resonates in exactly the same way there. And I probably realise that that's more important to me as I get older than perhaps I'd appreciate it certainly when I was younger. Culturally, I think we're really clear that we can't achieve anything if we don't have great people and if we don't look after our people. And you know, it's a little bit of a cliche to say people are your greatest asset, but it is true. And my role as a leader at L&G really is to help nurture and create a team of great people who get excited about coming to work, who have great opportunities and are able to be really successful. I don't need to be an expert in anything. I need to surround myself with really clever, dynamic, forthright people and just create the climate where they can thrive. And sometimes we get that right, and I'm quite sure sometimes we don't. But I'd like to think that the ambition to do that is consistent and really resonates with those people. It's a real passion for me. And it's something I feel enormous responsibility to keep doing and hopefully getting better and better at.
That's amazing. So you said inclusive capitalism, is that right?
Yes, that's right.
Was that in the L&G's heritage, or has that come in from the CEO and yourself and the board? Or
I think it's, you know, certainly developed over the last few years in a very well defined way. And that phrase is something that's, you know, it's come to the forefront in more recent years in terms of our branding. But I do think in terms of the approach that the business has taken, it's kind of there in the DNA in terms of how people have, or in the past, leaders and people before me have approached developing the brand and the direction of travel for Legal & General. So it doesn't feel like something that just came along last year, if that makes sense. I really feel it rooted in the DNA of a lot of our customer propositions. I know that years ago, for example, when there was a lot of change in the customer service market to outsource customer service operations overseas, it was something that Legal & General just didn't feel they wanted to do at that stage in terms of the impact on their customers and the service that they were able to offer. So that clear focus on making sure that we're really looking after customers has been there for, you know, long before me. I'm just proud to come along and kind of help keep it going, as opposed to taking any credit for inventing it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And it's great to see now that there's that sort of groundswell of more businesses that I think there's a concept that was coined in Silicon Valley, you know, doing well by doing good. So it's good to see sort of more British businesses starting to do that.
Yeah.
So we think about that British, the business strategy, some of the core components of the transformation that you've been architecting and leading, and then the pandemic hit. How did you deal with the challenges presented by the pandemic in the midst of a transformation and the transformation that you were going on? And it'd be good to maybe get a view of where you were. And then obviously, you know, we all went through that moment and the first sort of day, the first week, the first 2 weeks, and then, you know, where you are now. That whole journey would be great if you could put some color on it.
Okay. So, the transformation vision that we've got, certainly in my division, LGRI, and I think this aligns very well across the group actually, kind of has three core elements to it. Very much around protecting the business. So that's thinking around things like our information security, cyber resilience, operational resilience, all the things we need to do to protect our customers' data, our business data, and our systems, just in effect, so we can keep running the business and making the commitments that we've made to the market and to our customers. So protection is a core theme. Scaling is a second core theme. So we've got multitude of systems, processes, ways of working, etc., many of which are very effective within the parameters of what they were designed to be. But as our business grows and we take on more complex business, it becomes increasingly difficult for those systems or those processes or those models to work effectively. And they're not scalable. So we potentially end up having to have lots of manual operations, hire more people, and so on and so forth. So we really want to scale what we've got and take it forward into, you know, the multi-billion pound business that we are. The third theme is very much around transforming the business and fundamentally changing what it is that we're doing now. And that's very much the digital agenda. So digitizing what may potentially be a sort of an unwieldy legacy process or way of working now, and really exploiting the power of data, because we're a very data-centric business and therefore it's a huge asset to us. And I think across our business, those core themes probably resonate with every business division, transformation team we've got, so on and so forth. Okay. The pandemic obviously hit that and disrupted to differing scales. And what we had to do to respond to the pandemic, a lot of what we'd been doing under the Protect the Business banner played well to that. We were set up in certain instances to respond to that extremely well. We've been able to continue to scale the business or do the work to scale the business because we were able to revert to a remote model fairly easily, which means that most of our major programs continued, possibly slightly delayed, as opposed to, you know, really knocked for six. And the same is also true of our transformation agenda. What I would say, as we've emerged through the pandemic, is one of the things that's really struck me is how the world has changed to a certain extent, and how all the things that we said we would do around protecting, scaling, and transforming all remain relevant. But there are so many other drivers out there that we probably didn't have to contend with before the pandemic. I think we're facing into a really acute shortage of digital skills and expertise on the market. I think it's particularly difficult to find talent externally right now. And I think we, with hindsight, needed to have accelerated our kind of internal development programs to better equip the people that we've got to be the digital talent for the future. But that's something we're doing, so we can kind of crack on with that. I think what we've also learned is that the pandemic taught us that when the difficult stuff hits the fan, our ability to innovate is extraordinary. So the speed with which we got our customer operations up and running from home, where that wasn't already possible, which wasn't completely across the board, it was in pockets, was really phenomenal. And we're often quoted, some of the senior leaders are saying that we achieved in a period of 2 to 3 weeks what in perhaps a traditional program sense might have taken 4, 5, 6 months. Mm. The transition to really effective home working in that period, which was pretty rapid, you could argue in change management terms is probably in other programs would have in the past been an 18-month, you know, kind of initiative, and we did it in weeks. I like to apply a little bit of caution to that, because I think the model that's been created is slightly artificial. It's not necessarily what you'd sustain. In a way, it was almost easier because everybody was at home. So a lot of the nuances about hybrid working were not things that have yet had to be contended with. So I don't think it's fair to say we've totally digitally transformed our business. Aren't we great? Because we've responded in very specific circumstances. But the speed with which we did it was fantastic. That being said, if there was one lesson I would learn, I do remember various conversations in January where we were talking about this sort of COVID flu thing that was emerging and were we ready for it? And the pace with which we had those conversations did not match the pace that we had to have when we hit kind of end of February, March. Yeah. And I wish with hindsight we'd applied a bit more of that kind of crisis management approach at that stage, probably to smooth out the wrinkles as opposed to fundamentally transform. It just meant that a lot of people had to work some very long hours over a very short period of time. We probably could have made it a little bit less stressful for ourselves.
Yeah, that's fair. And what, just a couple of things you mentioned that was interesting and things that I've seen across the board is when it happened, it was probably one of the only times ever that executive boards across the globe were going through a similar thing. Okay, industries are different. Every business is different. Every culture is different. Every set of problems or opportunities are different. However, they were still experiencing the same thing, extreme change. I think some boards that we've seen have, you know, kind of got a bit of a taste for it now where they're thinking, well, that was really quick. Can you not just do that every time? And then others that actually didn't do it so successfully, and then some sat in the middle. So where does the sort of executive layer and board and the management at L&G sit now? Did it encourage more agile ways of working? Has it encouraged more, you know, quicker decision-making, prioritization? Did it, you know, garner a tighter business? How are you all shaped up after that as an event?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation. I think where we are as a business is we've said we did respond well to the pandemic, albeit apart from a few wobbles, we sorted our customer operations pretty quickly, got back on an even keel. And now we've proven we can run our business from home. That's quite a powerful statement that we couldn't make before the pandemic. What we've said is that there's nothing that gets pace going better than a crisis. And therefore, what can we learn from that crisis that will help us take the good bits and hold on to those, but not really slap ourselves on the back and say it was fantastic and it was textbook change management? Because as I've said, it was a really stressful, difficult situation. And yes, everyone rose to the top. Would you want people to work those hours at that pace under that kind of stress on an ongoing basis? No, you wouldn't. You know, it was a moment in time, and therefore it probably has exhausted people and really worn us out in terms of our ability to change. So we need to take a bit of time to chill out from that as well, and get our energy levels back. But let's not try and make it like it was those first 3 or 4 weeks of the pandemic forever, because I think everybody would burn out. What it has really made us do at a very senior level is think about what are those things that we want to carry forward. So in some cases, we were able to fast track governance. We didn't jeopardize any of our systems, any of our controls, anything that is fundamental to protecting our business. But we were able to make decisions that might have gone through various boards previously very, very quickly because we knew we had to do it. Those sorts of things are things that we should hold on to, because they demonstrate that is something you can carry forward out of a crisis into BAU. Because if you can make a decision about how to release change, for example, very, very quickly in a crisis, you should be able to do it just as quickly and just as robustly out of a crisis. I think also what was really powerful is how people came together. And that kind of sense in the pandemic of we're all in this together, we just need to sort this out for our customers, for ourselves, for our employees, and for each other. And I do think there's a sustainable level of that there now that perhaps may not have always been there before. And I think we will need to make sure we keep focused on that, because I think it could be quite easy to go back to some slightly siloed thinking or some slightly slower change management mechanisms that I think would be a real pity. Because as stressful as the pandemic was, and of course, as terrible as the human toll on it has been, in many, many ways, it has brought people together. Yep. It's brought my people closer to their families in some senses, because they spent so much time together. There's people who've had opportunities to play football in the garden with their kids that they didn't have, and all that kind of stuff. It's brought teams closer together because they've had to build new relationships virtually that has helped them understand each other better. I've met so many people's kids now virtually, which I would never have done before. You don't bring your children into the office, and I've seen their homes and I've seen their pets, etc. And it's culturally in so many ways brought us together. We're not socially distanced, we're just physically distanced. I don't even like the social distancing term because I don't think it represents what it is, to be fair. So all that kind of stuff just gives us such a great springboard or platform to really catalyze future change and to remember what it was like when it all felt, you know, the day that Boris said you need to stay at home. The next morning, I know we were all in a little bit of shock, but it really did pull us together. And I think that's hugely powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, some great insight there, Phil. I think that might be your next bit of thought leadership there. So sustainable lessons from the pandemic brought into business. But I quite like that sort of concept of human-centered change. I mean, that's what it's all about, regardless of whether there's a pandemic or not. You know, you've got to get people to pull in the same direction for an outcome. And, you know, it's hard, right? And it's about looking after each other through the good and the bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Legal & General as a business, I think, is particularly relationship-centric, if that's the right way to describe it. I think most people who work here, quite quickly when they join, that resonates and they can see how success is developed on, you know, strong relationships. But even Legal & General aside, one of my favorite interview questions is always, what do you think is the success to, or what was the ingredient to successful change or good projects or questions like that? It's a really simple answer. It's all about people. You know, you make change by forming relationships, by reaching out to each other, by collaborating, by understanding each other, and by working out how you're going to get from A to B or to C or whatever. And if you, you know, project management probably talks about stakeholder matrices and very formal artifacts, etc. But if you put those to one side, it's just about people coming together and working out how to make something better. And if you put kind of barriers and borders and different agendas to one side, it's just so powerful. And that's what the pandemic really proved in a great way for me.
Couldn't agree more. If you had your time again, is there anything you'd do differently at all? I know you've mentioned one or two things, but is there anything that you think you would do differently, or an opportunity you missed, or something you wouldn't do again?
Yeah, I mean, apart from really focusing on the threat to us a bit more solidly from the outset, as I've mentioned, and I'm sure everyone was in the same boat there, so I won't beat myself up too much about that. I think when the crisis hit in sort of March, when we moved into lockdown, we probably weren't strict enough about saying, actually, whilst we're responding to this, we should stop or slow down these things, because we probably burned through a lot of hours and a lot of stress for people working very, very long hours that could have made life a little bit easier if we'd have just pragmatically said, we should move this to the right. It probably did in the end move to the right by hook or by crook, but I think there would have been something quite powerful at the beginning to say, I'm going to take that off you, or I'm going to ask you to stop doing that because you need the bandwidth to do this.
Yeah.
And just thought about that a little bit more. I would almost call it a crisis trigger point to just look at your kind of prioritization, because things that you were doing that were critically important to the business, when something like a crisis, like a pandemic hits, cease to meet that definition, I think. And even regulatory things, we know that regulators were quite good at moving things to the right, the deadlines, et cetera, et cetera. I think we could have just probably supported some of our busiest teams a little bit better at the outset.
That's fair. Appreciate you sharing that. So let's change tack a little bit here. What would you say is your greatest achievement or most innovative initiative or project you've ever worked on?
I think what felt innovative to me, and I would base that definition on the scale of the change, was the Digital Workplace Program at LGR, which came out of the exit from Kingswood and our journey into agile working, because I think it really, it changed so much in the business. It changed the way, it changed the relationship we have with technology. So when I first joined, having landed on the tarmac from Australia and got on the train, it was very much a business that was pretty much office-based Monday to Friday, kind of remote, flexible working was there to a certain extent, but not the norm, and certainly not widespread. If I fast forward kind of 3 or 4 years from that point, the business has fundamentally changed. You know, significant populations of people had very agile, flexible working relationships. The technology had been completely replaced because people were previously on desktops, and you know, now we've kind of got much more mobile technology. Just the way we worked as a business really changed. It was much more about what you needed to do as opposed to where you needed to be, which of course was a great input for the pandemic because that took it to the next notch, obviously. So I would bank that as my greatest achievement, if that makes sense, in terms of the innovation, because it was about technology. It was about transforming our workspaces. It was about transforming the relationships that our people have with their line managers and with each other. So the breadth of the change was enormous. And I think innovative because we had to flex the style and the approach with different teams and different people in so many different ways. I think that's where the real innovation came in. You could argue getting people to use a laptop is not exactly the most innovative thing in the world, and I completely agree. But in a business where everyone has to think about where they work, what they're doing, who they're working with, how they use technology, how they use those workspaces, the combined effect of that, I think, is a pretty significant change. And I'm really proud of the lasting change that made for LNG.
And so you should be. When we talked before doing the show, you mentioned that you did a TED Talk. Can we talk about that?
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So, wasn't it a town? Was it? It was a town hall for LNG. Is that right?
It is. Yes. Yeah. We should be clear. Anybody who owns the copyright to TED Talk or who owns those, it wasn't a real TED Talk. It was a sort of the principle was, yeah, let's try and do a Phil TED Talk. Yeah. But yeah, we ran it, so monthly within LGRI, we run town hall sessions entirely virtually because we're a global business. They work really well because everyone from the US, Bermuda and the UK can dial in. It's another great change from the pandemic, because before we used to do kind of face-to-face sessions often in London. Turnout was good, but there's only so many people you can get in a room, right? So the virtual town halls are probably something I think we'll just continue with even when we've returned to the office. But we've tried to theme them this year around key strategic elements of our business, and we've also got different members of the ExCo kind of leading them. So my turn was to lead one on innovation, and I wanted to try to do it a little bit differently. So we filmed a TED Talk style presentation of me rambling for about 7 minutes about the value of innovation and perhaps how innovation conceptually seems a little bit intimidating to people who may be doing a job where they don't see where innovation fits in. And I was just trying to sow the seed or give everybody the idea that there are different types of innovation, and actually the words, you can put it to one size. If you're kind of solving problems or finding opportunities to do things differently, for me you're innovating, and that can be very low level simple, or it can be, you know, kind of enormous grand thing. So that was sort of the theme of the talk.
Okay, and so just almost like, you know, iterative incremental innovation is what you're suggesting?
Yeah, well, or both, you know, clearly there's a place for both. I think when we talk to the market or when we have senior leadership events, we often talk about innovation, meaning that really disruptive innovation, kind of and disruptive innovation. A key example I gave was when Apple invented the iPad, a device that nobody knew they needed, that suddenly everybody decided they wanted, kind of, you know, one of the most disruptive things on the technology market for some time. But for many people, you know, particularly, say, for example, if you're working in one of our customer facing roles or you're working in a finance team, that sort of disruptive innovation can seem so out there, you can kind of feel almost a little bit alienated by this constant dialogue of we need to innovate. And I just wanted, and I want everyone to feel part of that. I think everybody can be innovative in different scales or whatever, but I just want everyone to feel that they're part of that and that they all can and should and will hopefully make a contribution. So if we kind of focus people either incrementally or disruptively on small changes or big changes, they're all great. You know, small, the sum of the parts of the small ones in many cases leads to more sustainable change than even some of the disruptive pieces.
And is that encouraged throughout the organization? Because, you know, when I go into Manny, as you can imagine, sometimes it's in a lab environment, you know, in the top floor, and or it's showcased in the middle. So, you know, it can permeate, you know, by, you know, transparency and visual work that, you know, will then create viral change and all those kind of things. But are you suggesting it's more group wide at L&G so everyone can contribute and it can come from anywhere?
That is definitely the ambition. I would imagine you could probably talk to people around our group who would say, I don't think we're there yet. I always think it's a mistake to sort of suggest we're perfect. Hopefully the ambition is clear, but I think it's in presenting some of those ideas about what's the difference between incremental and, you know, disruptive innovation and just really trying to empower people to think a bit differently that we can make that spread across the group. So certainly our group, you know, our group Exco would be totally on that message. I just think we need to continually empower people to challenge and say, why am I doing this? Or what's a better way to do it? Or has anyone thought about this? I've long held the theory that the people with the answers to the biggest problems in the business are not the people in the C-suite. You know, it's the people who interact with our customers every day. It's the people who talk to our brokers. It's the people who have to deal with our systems and so on and so forth. All those things. And we just need to make sure that we're really listening to and tapping into what those people have to say, because that's where our future business will come from, not from the C-suite, not from people like me.
And how do you encourage that as a leader?
So I try to just empower people to do stuff and support them come what may with the outcome to a certain extent. So clearly we can't tolerate reckless risks, but I think we often talk about empowerment. I think you have to explain to people what you're empowering them to do, if that makes sense. I think as a leader, you stand up and say, you're empowered to do whatever you like to a huge group of people. Firstly, you don't actually mean that, because that could be extremely expensive. But secondly, I think people in the room walk away sort of reflecting, thinking, I don't know if I get it. What am I empowered to do? What do people want me to do? So I think we have to be a little bit more specific. We're empowering people to look at current processes and challenge where they're asked to do stuff where we just don't need to do it, and they're going round three hurdles when we could only go around one, for example. And I would specifically empower somebody to call that out and say, have you thought about doing it this way, and to empower them to try doing it that way to see if there's any kind of implication from it. I think Elon Musk had a very specific example, didn't he, in meetings, where he said, if it's a bad meeting, just walk out, because I'm going to. And at that point, then stood up and walked out. I think that's a very specific form of empowerment, but it's perhaps arguably a little bit disruptive. But what I might say to people is, if you are in a meeting that you're thinking, I'm not sure this is really adding any value, don't necessarily walk out, but maybe have a word with the chairperson afterwards and a suggestion of about how you could add more value, or say, maybe I don't need to come. Maybe I can just look at the minutes and just check stuff, this, that, and so on and so forth. So I think it's really easy to look at, you know, your Elon Musks and the true disruptive innovators who have the status and the position to just sort of ultimately do what they like and take no prisoners. But I think we just have to empower people in their own ways to challenge things and to find better ways to do it.
Yeah. So, it's a good point. So what, you seem like a really focused, well, you are focused from what I've, relatively short time I've known you, lots of energy, high tempo, can do, you know, delivering some great outcomes for the business. How do you manage your energy? What are your sort of leadership hacks as you keep yourself sane and healthy and energetic to be your best self, not only just for L&G, but, you know, for your friends and family and loved ones?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There's probably a few things. So I would like to tell you that I go to the gym 17 times a week, play tennis, and so on and so forth, but I don't. The best that I can do is I do have a fairly strict commitment of sticking to the 10,000 steps a day. And I'm a big fan, which I've sort of shared widely in the pandemic, of what I call the fake commute. So in the morning, long walk along the seafront before starting work is kind of a good time to just wake up, refresh, think about a few things and do something that sort of you don't just sort of fall out of bed and go and sit at your desk and do some work. Because a lot of people have said, although they don't miss being sat in traffic, they do miss that transition from home to the office, which they used to get from the commute, either to or from work. So I build in fake commutes into my day. My lunchtime is immovable. So nobody can book a meeting at lunchtime. And I think everyone gets that now. So 12 to 1 or 1 to 2 every day, I just kind of log off, get some food. And again, ideally, especially this weather, go for a walk or to sort of take a transition from that. I also have to be quite strict with devices. So the Outlook app, for example, was on the front screen of my mobile phone. It is not anymore. It's moved to the back screen. So I really have to go and look for it, as opposed to seeing that little icon of a new message that's coming up. Turned alerts off, because I don't generally think anything that important comes in through email that needs to be distracted. If it's really urgent, people will send me a WhatsApp message or a text, and that's fine, because that is those, you know, those real kind of crisis cases. And really strict about, you know, kind of when does work start and home life start as much as possible. So my weekends are quite sacrosanct. I'll do stuff if I need to, and I'm happy to do that, but it must be the exception rather than the rule. And a good network of people to bounce ideas off. And I don't mean that professionally. Like, my partner is a great foil for my conversations about knotty problems at work, because he just couldn't care less about work, for example. There's no relationship with my company insofar as my job. So if something's really frustrating me, he has this real ability to just cut through it and say, but doesn't that mean X? Or, but why wouldn't you do Y? And so many times it's like, do you know what? You're right. I've kind of lost that perspective a little bit. So I really cherish those kind of out of work relationships, even if I do sometimes stray into work talk.
I'll be a bit nosy and ask, is your walk in the morning device free?
Yes. Yeah. It absolutely is. It's usually with my partner, actually. So we'll be chatting and stuff like that, which is a good way to stay from the device. If I do it on my own, it's not device free insofar as that I'll probably listen to some music, yes. But it will be device free. I won't be looking at it. And probably my most controversial LinkedIn post was a picture of an iPhone where an artist had kind of shown one of the face huggers from Alien coming out and grabbing someone's face because they were so buried into it. And I was trying to make the point that actually my observation when I'm in London, this was a few years ago, is that people were literally walking along the street reading their devices, and they weren't really enjoying the city as I always do. And I love a walk through London city, the landmarks, just bustle and so on and so forth, but not glued to my device. And I think a few people took exception because they were kind of saying we should just get rid of smartphones. And I don't agree with that at all. I agree that they can connect you with people, but I do think we should switch off those devices. And I think we all have to learn how to do that.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. There's a guy on my entrepreneur network. He's a Dutch guy called Elko de Boer. So internet entrepreneur, and he did this great kind of TED talk style, which was called, it was a take on intermittent fasting, but being internet fasting. So he only has two parts of the day where he goes online, and then he carries around an old Nokia for the rest of it. So friends, family, close business associates can contact him via text and stuff. And yeah, I try my best to follow that, but I find it quite hard. But the mornings, I'm with you. I sort of get up and have an hour to myself. Hopefully, in the not too distant future, I'll be moving down towards the sea, so I'll be able to do that too. But at the moment, it's just giving you that me time in the morning to have an hour to yourself, where you know you've got no interruptions and you can get those moments of clarity and actually get your intuition working in your favor as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really important for your mental health. I know we talk a lot about mental health, and rightly so. And there are all sorts of things that can boost or can drain your mental health. And I think being constantly connected to a device is one of them. And I think one of the things that I would also say that I've seen through the pandemic, and perhaps even recognized in myself, is that it's almost a bit oversensitivity to what people say in an email or a message or whatever, because you don't have that personal context and you can kind of read a bit into it. So I don't access emails after a certain time of the day, because then my brain switches off, because I find later in the day, perhaps because I'm tired, I am a bit more oversensitive to what someone said. What do they mean by that? Have I done something wrong, and so on and so forth? And I've just learned to chill out from that and step back a little bit. But I think we've all got to do what works for us. What works for me won't work necessarily for you or for other people. And I think it's, we can conversely, despite everything I've said, put people under pressure to have no devices at the dinner table or go for a walk in the morning or whatever. Everyone's different and everyone's got to work out what works for them. So people should test some stuff as well. You know, the walk in the morning. I know there's some people on my team who'd rather die than do that. You know, they are not early morning people and therefore that's not for them. But they're probably late, you know, owls, as it were. So in the evening, they might really enjoy that.
Yeah, true. And it's also, what I've learned over the years is, don't give yourself a hard time if you can't keep a routine.
Yeah.
You know, just reset and get back into it. And if it breaks, it breaks. And, you know, so be it. Yeah. And you can always get back into it and test other things. So.
Yeah. Life happens.
Exactly. So, I mean, I've so many good stuff. So much here to go on. But I always try and kind of keep these things to sort of 40, 45 minutes. As I know if I'm in the gym after about 45, 50, I might switch off or in the car. So I've got a couple more questions for you, if that's all right.
Okay. Yep.
So I love the purpose behind, you know, LNG, inclusive capitalism. You know, I love the story that you've been sharing. It really feels like it's, you know, a leading culture and a leading business in society. What's the future for you and, you know, LNG Group in that context of, you know, benefiting the wider society and you as a leader, you know, delivering, you know, game-changing transformation?
Yeah, so I think as a group, it's just continuing to scale that ambition. We have a responsibility to do that. You know, we have capital accessible to us to invest, far outstrips many other people in the world, many other companies in the world, I should say. So therefore, we need to think about how we do that. And we need to think about that really carefully. And I think continue to build that ambition. And one of the things that our group CEO often says, which I really like, which he often says to a kind of leadership sessions, is that we are the we. So it's very much around nobody else is going to do it. We are. So as a group of employees, as a group of leaders, etc., we have to think about the solutions to these problems. Just yesterday, he was kind of commenting in a communication session around, we're really good in the world about talking about climate change, but are we yet really good about acting on it? And it's no use sort of saying, what are they doing over there? It's around, you know, it's for us. We are the we kind of thing to come up with those things. So I think that's just what the future is going to hold, immediate and long term, which is thinking about how we invest, how we build out our propositions, how we look after our customers, how we respond to how the world is changing, but continuing to do so clearly in a profitable way. It'd be foolish to suggest otherwise, but in a way that hopefully, you know, when I retire, I leave behind, or when I die, leave behind a world that, you know, is a little bit better or a little bit more sustainable or just more inclusive, because, you know, we just need to do that. And I think that purpose will resonate louder and louder.
Brilliant. Any ending thoughts or advice for our listeners? So the majority are, you know, change agents, CXOs, you know, interims, consultants, private equity. It seems to be the main mix of people that do listen to this show. So on the whole, everyone is going to be having similar interest to, you know, leading successful transformation, you know, for not only a better society, but also for, as you know, profit and gains and growth and successful businesses. So, and a lot of money can be wasted in failed transformation, as you know very well, and can lead to burnout and mental health issues. So what advice do you have for our listeners around leading transformation? This closing thought.
I think I've stolen my own thunder earlier on by kind of almost duplicating the point, but I do think when you read those articles, the kind of the clickbait one, 6 reasons why transformation fails and all that kind of stuff, which usually regurgitates something that probably isn't terribly helpful. But I think if you haven't connected the dots between the people involved, where the key people are now, where they need to get to, I think your transformation is probably going to fail. And it's not just about stakeholders, it's customers, it's users, employees, whatever groups of people are going to be affected. And it is a little bit around that, really, as a transformation leader, taking that time to step back and do that whole walk a mile in their shoes kind of thing. So if I'm doing a piece of work to look at a fundamental change to how our actuaries work, how are our actuaries going to feel? What's the contract with them? We're really good at sort of making change and saying, we won't need to do this anymore. But we never really say to people what they'll do instead. We just say to people, oh, you won't need to use that spreadsheet anymore. Okay, but if you don't fill in the blanks, it kind of sounds like I don't have a job anymore. Well, if you say to someone, you won't need to use that spreadsheet anymore, but you'll have great analytics tools and we'd really like you to work on the model because we think this can really help our longevity assumptions in the US. You're kind of like, okay, I get it. So I think that's what I'm talking about. It's really about selling the ambition, buying in the engagement with people, because all change is about people. Even if you're putting in a new system, the system doesn't mean anything if the people who need to use the system don't buy into what the system can do for them.
Brilliant. I think that's a great way to end the show. Phil, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm glad we got to do this in the end. Was there any questions that you'd have liked to be asked that I didn't ask, or are we all good?
No, definitely not, because I'm just going to come up there. I'm not going to fall into that trap, because I'll ask the question and you'll say, in which case then I'm going to ask you that question. So absolutely not. You asked all the right questions, definitely.
Fair enough. Well, I look forward to catching up with you in person again. And, it looks like we're hopefully getting through the other side of this last 18 months. And may I wish you all the best for everything that you're doing, not only in what you do, but what you're doing with LNG as well. It's a terrific story. Thank you for sharing it.
Great. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Change Society podcast. And if you want to know more about how SNS can help you and your organization, there are three main ways. Number one, subscribe to this podcast and also check out some of our cutting edge knowledge and ideas on the insights page of our website. Number two, if you're a senior leader or change agent, join one of our change communities to network and share with like-minded individuals, both online and off. And finally, if you need to solve a problem across business change, agility, delivery or transformation, and don't want to go down the traditional consulting route, shoot us an email to hello@sullivanstanley.com.